Let's open our Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes. People are afraid of this book. They're afraid of the depression of it. But as we're going to see, it's really not depressing. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of hope in Ecclesiastes. And a lot of people have used it, by the way. Do you remember November 22nd, 1963? If you were old enough to remember that date, you probably remember where you were that day. Because that was the day that Kennedy was shot. And people who were people whose memories are sharp on that particular day, who can remember that day. It was such a shock to hear. I was only 10 years old, and I remember where I was and what was going on. And people, I was in a little store in Camp Evers in Scotts Valley, California, this little wide spot in the road down my hometown. And all of a sudden, I realized there were grown-ups talking over the aisles to one another, which is not a common occurrence in a store. Grown-ups who didn't know each other were talking over the aisles and sucking in their breath and saying, "Did you hear that? Did you hear that?" And the radio was on in the store, and we heard that President Kennedy had been assassinated. At the time, of course, they were hoping he wasn't dead yet, but he was. Did you know that later that afternoon, the speech he had planned contained these words? "There is an appointed time for everything. There is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to shun embracing, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace." It seems to me supremely ironic that he was going to quote from Ecclesiastes chapter 3 this poem, and it is a poem. I don't know what Kennedy was going to say about it. I don't know how much of it he was going to quote. Usually when people quote this section of Ecclesiastes, it is for the purpose of reminding us that there's times for us to make decisions, times for us to do various things. And we decide, but there are appropriate times for these things. And actually, if that's what Kennedy was going to talk about, it's usually, like I mentioned, it's usually how people use the verse. It's a mistake, and it would have been a mistake. Because actually, in reality, what these verses talk about is the sovereignty of God. The fact that God has set up patterns. The fact that the Lord is in charge of life and death. That he's the one who sets the patterns for human life. And John Kennedy, of course, having prepared that speech, had no idea that God had another plan for the events of that particular day in November of 1963. He lived out the truth of the passage and never got a chance to quote it to the American people. And we look at a situation like that and we think to ourselves, what in the world does God mean to impart to us by way of wisdom in a passage such as this? And we're going to look through chapters 3 and 4. I mean, we think back to the assassination of President Kennedy, and we know that he was a philanderer. We know more about him now that Jackie Onassis passed away. And after she passed away, a lot of stuff started coming out that everybody or people in the know apparently knew, but they didn't want to bring it out while she was still alive. And then after she died, all this stuff has come out about Kennedy. When you look at his life and you look at the fact that he was going to quote these verses and it draws you into Ecclesiastes, and then you realize he died at 46 at the prime of his life at a time when everybody was expecting the great things were going to come through him. Then we find out later there was a whole lot of phoniness in his moral life and so on. You know what it is? It's a huge illustration for the entire book of Ecclesiastes. And that is exactly where the wisdom comes from. His life is an illustration of all of the wisdom of the book of Ecclesiastes. What looks good on the surface often is not so behind the scenes. And what looks like it ought to succeed and is at the prime of life, at the very moment when we ought to be saying, yes, it ends. It ends. The wind blows and the bloom is off the tree, just like that. And we say, what? Does anything make sense? And I remember people at the time and many times since then just simply raising their hands and saying, does anything make sense in this world? Well, that's what Ecclesiastes is about. That is what Ecclesiastes is about. It asks that question, expecting a negative answer. Wisdom literature, of which Ecclesiastes is a part, wisdom literature in the Bible, is literature that gives us wisdom for how to live our lives successfully. It does not answer all of our questions, but it teaches people, if they're willing to listen, it teaches them how to live wisely. And Ecclesiastes is the one book, as I mentioned last week, that comes in the back door and the back door of wisdom and says, I will show you wisdom by showing you all the things that are not wisdom. I'll show you ultimate peace and ultimate goodness by showing you all the places that you'll never find it. And by going through, beginning in verse 1, going to the end of the book, he says, I have looked under the sun. Remember the two phrases? Under the sun and vanity, vanity. Those two phrases sum it up. That which is without the view of God, only under the sun, on the earth. When you look at life, looking for hope and looking for, you know, ultimate reality and ultimate fulfillment here on earth, you are not going to find it. Under the sun, there is nothing but vanity, vanity. That's the moral of the story. And he goes from the beginning, Solomon, goes from the beginning to the end of this book, basically saying, I tried this, and I tried that, and I have seen it from all directions. And he says, let me tell you, there is nothing on this earth that will give you the final, ultimate answers. And that actually is the beginning of wisdom. As long as you still think you can find answers to life here on earth, as long as you still have hope that humans are going to figure it out and ever do it right, my friend, you're walking away from God. And furthermore, you won't be able to enjoy the life you've got because it'll make you miserable, the fact that you can't figure it all out. And an assassination happens here and a country falls there and they find out about mass murder over here and crimes are happening over there and the newspapers are full of it all. And you get more and more depressed as time goes by if you're looking only under the sun. You won't even be able to enjoy the good things for fear of the next bad thing that's going to happen. You know, you're enjoying something good, and there's a good moment in your life, and then you think of the next depressing thing that might happen. You just go, oh, bummer. And that comes from looking at life only under the sun. But the amazing thing is that when you look at life realistically, and you don't expect that much from it, and you look to God instead of this world, and you really commit your soul to Him, it's the most amazing thing happens. It frees you up to enjoy even the little things that occur. It frees you up to say, I'm going to enjoy every good thing God has given me. But until then, until you do that, until you realize, if you're a deep thinker, until you realize there is a God, you're going to look in this world for something with ultimate truth. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, I know people who are very happy. They've burned enough brain cells that they just don't think very much. Well, okay, that's their problem. But I'm talking about deep thinkers. I'm talking about people who really think about life and death and eternity. If you're one of those kind of people, you are not going to find happiness here until you realize it's not going to ever be found here. And you come to God. And then, amazingly, as a byproduct, you can find incredible happiness. Not ultimate, not capital H happiness, but small H happiness in abundance once you understand who God is. And that's really the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. That's where we find it. Now, if you've read through, are you guys reading Ecclesiastes? Or are you just waiting and kind of gritting your teeth here on Wednesday nights, kind of going, okay, well, if you've read Ecclesiastes, if you know the book, you know that there are several points throughout the book where small things are sprinkled in, and he says, I've discovered that this is the main, you know, I've looked at it this way, and it looks really bad, and I've looked at this, and it's not giving me anything, and I've looked at it, and this thing's falling apart, but I have discovered this, and he uses the phrase, gift of God. This is a gift of God. A man should enjoy such and so because it's a gift of God, and he should just enjoy that. This author is not an atheist. Solomon is not an atheist. He knows that God is there. He is simply purposely viewing life from the perspective of a man who's saying, will this life give us ultimate meaning? And the fact that he's not an atheist brings him back over and over again to that recurring theme, and we'll see it again twice tonight. The recurring theme of what is it, what can a person who already belongs to God do to enjoy a life in which there's so much failure? If you already belong to God, what can you do to actually enhance your life when there's so much failure and sin and terror in the world? Really, so many things go wrong in this world. What can you do? Well, that's what we're going to look at tonight. In fact, by the time we're done, we'll see three things not to do and three things to do, okay, in chapters 3 and 4 of Ecclesiastes. So let's begin again. The first nine verses, or first eight verses of Ecclesiastes 3 are a poem that essentially reminds us God is in control. John Kennedy was the classic example. He probably thought he was somewhat in control, and if anybody could be, it would be the President of the United States, the leader of the free world, one of the most powerful men in all of human history, at a point in human history where there was a lot of power to wield, and he wielded it at the tender age of 46, no less. And yet, God's timing overtook him, and that is exactly the message here. You see, the word time in verse 1, and then it repeats it over and over and over again. It means an appropriate time for a particular event. As a matter of fact, the word event or activity is actually the word for delight. There's a time for every delight, but he doesn't just mention delights here. He mentions both delights and debummers. Sorry. I just thought of that. I was no charge. He mentions the good stuff and the bad stuff, okay? He mentions the appropriate moments, not because they're all happy, but because they're all unavoidable. And he says, listen, God has set up a pattern to human life that we cannot control. In Greek, there were two ways to discuss time, chronos and kairos. Those are two Greek words for time. Chronos was time in a line. Chronos is what we measure with a chronometer, a watch, or a clock. That's chronos time. Kairos, on the other hand, was appropriate moments. A kairos moment, a kairos time, is a moment when something needs to happen. Babies, for instance, are not born according to chronos. They are born according to kairos. So you can set the date you think you're going to have that baby, but if you have the baby naturally, you just have to wait until the baby comes. And the doctor will say, well, it'll probably come within these few days. But you don't set your watch and say, oh, well, the baby's supposed to come at 7:45 on such and so day. You don't do that. See, that's chronos time. Babies come in kairos time, the appropriate moment when it's ready, when it's time. See, that's all of this right in here. This is not chronos. God is not setting out a calendar in which certain things are going to happen. What he's doing is he's saying there are moments that recur in all human lives. Appropriate times, moments that have been preordained for all humans to experience. Now, God does know the dates and times, but that's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is every human being has events in their life that are it's time for such and so to happen. It's time for this to occur. There's a time to weep. There's a time to dance. There's a time to enjoy. There's a time to grieve. And he goes all through these. It's a kind of an ad hoc list, really, just to give us the impression, the reality. There's a time to do this and there's a time to do that. It's not all one thing. And wise is the person who knows and leans into those times. If you're in a time of grieving and you say, this is a time when I need to grieve, then fine, grieve. Don't be down on yourself for not rejoicing. But there will come a time to rejoice. And at the time to rejoice, rejoice. Don't be down on yourself for not grieving. You know, one of the most difficult things about being in the ministry, and I love being in the ministry, and the blessings far outweigh the difficulties, but let me tell you something that is difficult about being in the ministry. And I think it may be true in a lot of other professions as well, but the scripture says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. In normal life, you can do that because you don't know enough people who are weeping. Maybe one of your friends is going through grief. In ministry, what you end up dealing with is several of those in a day. And two or three rejoicings. I have gotten off the phone with a person who is literally weeping uncontrollably, having experienced some devastating loss. I have gotten off the phone with that person only to have the phone ring 2 minutes later and have a person share an outrageous joy that they were experiencing. Now that strips your gears. It strips your gears. You think, how can I possibly rejoice with this person when this person over here is weeping? There's an old saying that a mother is no happier than her least happy child. How can you rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep? Here's how. By knowing that it's God's will to do that and go ahead and shift gears. You don't have to strip gears. I have done funerals where I stand on a windswept hill. It seems rare to do a funeral on a beautiful day. It's happened, but it's rare. Very often it's windy and it's cold, and it matches the mood when you're standing at a graveside. And then gone that just within an hour to some joyous occasion, some church thing where folks are gathering and there's happiness and there's joy. And you know what I need to do? I need to realize there's a time for weeping and there's a time for rejoicing. Except under most circumstances, you have a little time to put in the clutch and shift the gears and lean into the new experience. But sometimes you have to do that on purpose. Sometimes you have to realize this is a time for rejoicing and this is a time for grieving. And this is a time when I need to be angry about something. And this is a time when I shouldn't be angry about something. And so on. And what he's saying is God arranges human life with these cycles in it on purpose. It's not all one thing. We keep thinking, well, my life ought to be like one thing. I want rejoicing. And that's what I'm after. And I'll buy drugs if I have to, but I'm going to rejoice. And that's what I got to have. That's all I want. I'm going to self-medicate until I feel like I'm like on this plane of rejoicing no matter what. That's not the way life works. God has designed it with a cycle, and he knows when you are going to be born, and he knows when you're going to die. And in between, he has set it up to work this way. The problem with all of this is that we don't know why, and that's the next thing he gets into. Verse 9, what profit is there to the worker from all that he does in his toil? Look at these cycles. They recur over and over again. Life hasn't changed. You know, people go through the same stuff generation upon generation. Humans have the same trials, and they're just as bad. Don't you wish you could look back to your kids and say, I want to transplant my personal experiences into your little brain. I want to put them on a floppy disk. I'm going to put them in open your mouth, punch the enter button. I want my wisdom and experience to get into your head before you screw your life up. Because I can tell you from experience, it's not worth it. See? We want to do this, and yet every generation has to learn it all by themselves, it seems, over and over and over, and you get to a point where you say, why? What profit is there? That's exactly what Solomon comes to. He's looking at it under the sun, remember, not from an eternal perspective, although we will see an eternal perspective coming through the pages, but you know, he's just looking at it under the sun. He says, what profit is there? Why do we go through this over and over again? It seems senseless. It's like gerbil activity, you know? We're just running on the little wheels in this little glass cage. I'm so sick of it. You ever feel like a gerbil? Maybe you're not. Midlifers feel like gerbils, you know? When you're young, it's like this great, huge expanse out in front of you. Life is exciting, and you're looking forward to all this stuff. And by the time you get into your 40s and 50s and 60s, you're going... you know, I feel like a gerbil. Sometimes, you know, what is the, if you're looking at it only under the sun and you're looking for the world to give you something to go for, when you're young, it looks like the world's going to give you a lot. You get into middle age and later middle age and later age, and you're going, wait a minute. What's the use of all this? Well, that's what he's coming to, see. I've seen the task which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. That's a great thing. In order to keep them busy. I've seen what God has done, and it is gerbil activity. He's got us running around here making a living. We get up in the morning, we go to work, we come back, we save our money. Why? So we can spend it. On what? Who cares? And it's on and on and on and on and on, and every year we just pay off the credit card from last Christmas, and it's Christmas again. And it's on and over and over and over again. He says, I see what God has done. He's given us just something to occupy our time. He's keeping us busy. Which means it's not the production on an eternal level, is it? There must be something else going on. It must be something more important than what we're producing here. Because what we're producing here doesn't last. It goes away, and this cycle keeps happening over and over and over again. And I'm not seeing anything long-term. I'm not seeing anything really permanent. It lasts for a few years. And so maybe there's something more important in all of God's providence and sovereignty, setting this whole system up with the days and the months and the weeks and the times and the kairos and all these events in my life. And it's big. I can see it. It's happening around me. My feelings are into it. And yet, it's not going to last. There must be something else going on in this activity level that he's given to us. He has made everything appropriate in its time, and he's also set eternity in their heart. Yet, so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. In other words, he's given them an awareness that there should be something more important. He put eternity in their souls. There's a sociological term, homo religiosus. It means the religious being. We are normally called homo sapien, human beings. Homo religiosus means the religious being, and it's the other way to describe humans, because humans must think about God. Animals don't think about God. Humans think about God. In every single culture, they're thinking about God. When they tell you, I'm not thinking about God, they are thinking about God. When they say, I'm an atheist, it is, they know the God they don't believe in. They've decided they don't believe in him, and they know who he is. I don't believe in him. I've decided. That's an atheist. People do think about God. God put eternity in their hearts, yet it says, in a way that they can't figure everything out. We want a plan. We want something that's going to last. We want something that's going to go on into eternity. In Japan, there are businesses that have a 250-year business plan. A 250-year business plan. Now, call me a lightweight, but I think that is a huge waste of time. A 250-year business plan so that their business will outlive them. Does that strike anyone else as really fruitless? I mean, like, meaningless and pointless? When I die, I'm leaving a huge pile of money that is going to continue growing for another 250 years. Oh, well, that really puts my soul at rest. Does that make you feel better? You see, human beings are always having to think of planning. We want something to matter. Yes, we do. And we try and pretend that matter matters, but it doesn't matter. And that's because eternity is in our hearts. But not enough to really understand everything. You see, we live in a fallen world. We've rebelled against God. And he has allowed the world itself to become the testing ground that will force us to start thinking about him again. That's exactly what's happened. We fell and turned away from him in his creation, fell in love with the creation itself. He said, fine, I'll use the creation, I'll use the work, I'll use the entire environment. And I will, because you were created to be with me, I'm going to let you thirst for me. I'm going to let you come to an end of yourselves. I'm going to put eternity in your hearts. And I'm going to let you know enough to know you can never do it on your own, and you're going to be frustrated, but your frustration will have a long-term productive, hopefully a long-term productive goal, and that'll be to fear me, which is what he gets to in the next couple verses. He doesn't know what, latter part of verse 11, man doesn't know what God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in his labor, this is a gift from God. That simple thing, we'll get back to that. And this is part of the recurring. You know what I did? I went through all of the book of Ecclesiastes and I put little asterisks next to each verse and I put a little heart next to each verse where he says, this is what I figured out. And you can trace what he says all the way from chapter 1 that way. Where he says, I've discovered you should live life simply and just enjoy it. But we'll get to that in just a minute. This is one of those heart passages here. Verse 14, and I know that everything God does will remain forever. Now, it's not what man does. Everything man does just flies apart. It never lasts. Whatever we try and make it eternal. You know, we try to say, this thing will last. This is the greatest ship ever built. It's unsinkable. You know, and God says, oh, really? I have an ice cube out here. I have an ice cube. Just an ice cube. And our unsinkable ship is gone. Man tries to make all this eternal stuff. But God really does make eternal stuff. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take from it. For God has so worked, underline the last line, that men should fear him. And that is the same word for fear that you find in Proverbs. What is the beginning of wisdom? The fear of the Lord. Yirah. It means to reverence him personally. That's why God sets it up in a way that we can never figure it out on our own. That's why consistently in our lives and in our world, stuff happens that we cannot account for. And when we think we have it figured out, something else happens and it totally goofs up our thinking. We plan and it falls apart. The world plans and it falls apart. You look back into history and what you find is that man sort of stumbles through history. You watch it on TV, it looks like it was a real plan. But that's all in hindsight. That's all hindsight. When they do these film deals about the last 1,000 years, you know, it's all filling the TV waves now. You know, everything about the last 1,000 years. And it makes it look like there's this march of time. Are you kidding me? It's a stagger of time. Time is just blathering along. Human history is making it up as it goes. Except that behind it, God is doing something. If you've ever been involved with the production of some mighty thing, any big project, you know how many things go wrong behind the scenes before the project is finished. And then afterwards, when they hand out the awards, it looks to everybody else like this thing came off without a hitch and everybody's a hero and everything's wonderful, but you know it only happened by accident. You know that behind the scenes, so many mistakes were made. So many things went wrong, you know? Well, you see, God does this on purpose. He wants our lives to not make sense on their own, because if they did, we would never come to Him. It is the fear of the Lord that He wants us to have. That's why life is so confusing. That's why human history, if you're looking for a rhyme or a reason to it, there simply isn't one. There isn't one. And as a matter of fact, humanity has a philosophy today in which they're not expecting one. Philosophical naturalism, atheism, evolution. All of those things are of the same philosophical position. And they're not looking for a rhyme or a reason. They really are making it up because they believe that the universe is eternal instead of God. So they're not trying to blend it all together or make some large thing come together. But the problem is it's totally unsatisfactory to us. It is totally unsatisfactory. Our minds do not like the idea that life is meaningless. We don't like the idea that we are accidental. We want to know that there is meaning to something. And it is that thirst coupled with, that desire coupled with the fact that life doesn't work and it has these recurring cycles and it still doesn't work and we never get it right. About the time we think we're getting it right, we die of old age. And why? The whole purpose. You couple that desire with the mess that is the world, and God says, I'm doing this so that you will look beyond you to me, so that you will fear the Lord. Because if life worked the way we think it ought to, none of us would have come to Jesus. None of us would come to God. You know why? Because we'd rather be God than be like Him. And it's a fine line, isn't it? Between wanting to be like the Lord and wanting to be the Lord. A fine line. So He keeps reminding us through living in a fallen world that we are not God and we have to turn to Him. Now He moves on. Well, verse 15 continues and concludes the thought, really. That which has been, that which is, has already been. That which will be, has already been. And God seeks what has passed. In other words, He's going to bring all of the accounts due. Now, verses 16 of chapter 3 to the end of chapter 4 are a whole new topic. God allowing wickedness to permeate the fallen human culture. You'll see this again and again. How He allows wickedness. Think, well, how could God allow this or that or the other thing? Well, He does. And it causes us no end of consternation. We think He ought to make life easy and simple. Problem is, we live in a sinful world. And this author, Solomon, now starts to outline some of that. He says, furthermore, I've seen under the sun that in the place of justice, there is wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, there is wickedness. In other words, I see wickedness, meaning crime and bad stuff. I see this happening where I expect it. I see it happening in the bad part of town. But I also see it happening where in the justice building. And I see it happening in the places where righteousness ought to be. I see it happening in both places. That's terrible. And it is terrible. I mean, anybody here been involved in any lawmaking at all? Anybody here been involved with government at any level? Politics at any level, even what you see on TV, which has definitely been filtered and adjusted to be sold as news, okay, it's news product, that's what it is, it's processed. But even that shows us how much graft there is in the average human government, not just ours. Ours is actually one of the better ones. That ought to really make you feel terrible. I mean, seriously, we talk about the graft in the United States. It's a Sunday school compared to what's going on behind the old iron, the old rusty curtain, the governments that are, some governments literally run by the mafia. It's amazing. He says, I see this. It's terrible. I see the whole crime thing everywhere, verses 16 to 22. He says, I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order to see that they are simply beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As the one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath. There is no advantage for a man over a beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. In other words, human beings die and animals die. I see human beings just like animals. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and they'll return to the dust. And how do you know that the breath, or the soul, is the idea, ruach, the breath of the man ascends upward? How do you know that when a human dies, male or female, that their soul goes upward, and when a beast dies, their soul goes downward? How do you know that? So that was apparently the idea in those days, that's what happened. Now, we know that when the soul is separated from the body, when death occurs, a human soul does depart, and it waits for judgment. That person is still there, and they're waiting for judgment from God. But this author, Solomon, is looking at the whole thing. He's looking at the crime, and he's saying basically two things in this passage. He's saying, number one, I told myself God is going to judge both the righteous and the wicked. I'm going to trust him to do that. I see all of this crime. I see everything going on, and I reminded myself God is going to judge both the righteous and the wicked. And then he says, I reminded myself that human beings really, on their own, have no idea where their souls are going to go after they die. And I have written in the margin of my Bible, unless someone tells them. Unless someone tells them. See, remember, this is under the sun. This is looking at it strictly from a human perspective. How do you know your soul is going to go anywhere? How do you know you're not just going to disappear? I was in a talk with a bunch of other guys who were religious people, all of them. They all had these different opinions about where the soul goes after you die. It was very interesting, except one guy, philosophical naturalist, he believed that your soul simply disappeared. That you were just your body, basically. You are your body. When your body dies, you cease to exist. That's what he believed. Everybody else in the whole group believed that there was some sort of life after death. And it's an interesting thing. From a human perspective, how do you know the difference? How do you know the difference? People say, well, I believe I'm going to heaven. How do you know you're going to heaven? How do you know where your soul's going to go? See, unless someone tells you, I believe I'm going. How do you know? Jesus is the only authoritative voice, the only one to come back from the dead, who says. And that's why Christians speak very confidently about life after death. But this is written from the perspective of sheer humanity. And he comes to a hopeless perspective on that basis. He says, you know, I look at the crime and it reminds me people are a lot like animals. Well, if you're just looking under the sun and you're looking at human beings, they are a lot like animals. Verse 22. I've seen that nothing is better than that a man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? He's not going to know what happens afterwards, and he has no way of understanding what's going to happen in the next life. Now we do, and when you read this, understand Solomon is speaking about the hopelessness of trying to find ultimate meaning just here on earth. If that's what you're going to do, you're going to see humans as nothing different than the animals. Now let me ask you something. Is that or is that not the basic thesis of what we're being taught in our science classes? You see where it's going? It's life under the sun. Exactly. Then he goes on more about human beings. Abuse, verses 1 through 3 of chapter 4. I looked, I saw all the acts of oppression. The Hebrew word oppression actually can be translated abuse. And it would be much more appropriate to our culture because we know the term abuse. It's a buzzword. It means a stronger person taking advantage of a weaker person. In any way, the word oppression is what's used here. You see, I see all these acts of oppression which are being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead, who are already dead, more than the living, who are still living. In other words, I said to anybody who died already, wow, you're in good shape. I'm really glad that you're out of here. See, that's pretty depressed. But you know what? Do you know that the Christians used to have a huge party back during the persecutions, back in the second century? One of the things that Christians did was if a Christian died, they had a huge party, kind of like a birthday party for him. Because they were so convinced that their real life was in the next life that they saw death as a real graduation. And that is exactly how Christians have seen it. It's that it's something to look forward to, something you've wanted to achieve, you see. Well, that's what he's saying. He's saying, when you just look at the world, he says, I'm just congratulating the people who've already died. But he says, I got one better. Better off than both of them is the one who's never existed, who's never even seen the evil activity that's done under the sun. Kind of the low point in Solomon's talk here. Is it hyperbole? Probably. He's probably exaggerating on purpose for literary meaning. And yet, when you're really depressed and you look at the sin under the sun without any eternal redemption, it is so depressing. It totally is. It's exactly what he's saying. Then he goes on to the next topic. He says, abuse is crime, verses 3:16 to 22. Abuse, chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Greed is the next one, 4 through 8. Yeah, I've seen another labor, and every skill which is done is a result of rivalry, competition between man and his neighbor. This, too, is vanity and striving after. When I see people doing stuff to each other, and their whole motivation is greed, and they're just trying to destroy each other. He said, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full of rest, or with peace, is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. Now, we'll get back to those two verses. 5 and 6 are very important. I just want to point out in verse 4, he says, you know what I noticed? I noticed that the only thing that motivates people is greed. They're just after each other. They just want to beat each other out. And you say, well, I haven't noticed that. I see people who are nice. There are some nice people. Have you worked in retail marketing recently? I talked to a friend who works at a local big department store. He said, I can't believe how much stealing going on. He said they caught a woman who brought in her little boy, about 6 years old or 5 years old, into the store, and she completely dressed him, all in new clothes, and walked him right straight out of there without paying. Of course, she got caught. But can you imagine? This little boy is learning. He's learning a lifestyle from his own mom, who's using him as a tool for shoplifting, a little living tool for shoplifting. This fella said that it's just incredible how much stealing is going on. Well, that's what Solomon's pointing out here. At the base of the human soul, there is this greed which promotes competition between people that is godless. And he says, this is terrible. It's useless. Then I looked, verse 7, again, I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent. In other words, he didn't have to spend his money on anybody else, having neither son or brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? He says, this too is vanity. It's very grievous. Greed, when a person amasses more and more and more and more, and you think to yourself, why? And he never stopped to ask, why am I doing this? He just kept going and going and going and going, you know? And it's like, don't you ever stop and ask? But greed has its own motivation on the inside, where you never stop to evaluate. You just got to have more and got to have more. He says, this is vanity too. This is a complete... I used to drive down... my folks had a place in Lake Tahoe, and we used to go up there for vacations in North Shore of Lake Tahoe, and we'd go down Lake Shore Drive, which I don't know if some of you guys know where that is maybe. And there are these humongous, beautiful homes down right on the lake, and we'd go down and look at them. They're gorgeous. But you know what amazed me? These things are huge. Some of them are... you know, 8, 10, 15,000 square feet, bigger than this entire church facility. And I found out two people living in them, or one person living in them. You go, why? Why? What's the use? It's amazing. He says, it's vanity. He says, emptiness. He doesn't say it's a sin. He just says it's useless. It's a waste. Verse 9, two are better than one. Now, he's shifting gears, and we'll get back to it, but he's shifting gears. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls, the one will lift his companion up. But woe to the one who falls when there's no one to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist. A cord of three strands isn't quickly torn apart. Now, just hold that thought, okay? We're going to come back to it. Because then he goes on and gets even more depressed, okay? He says something bright in these verses, which we're going to end with, okay? I'm going to save it for the end. It's like dessert. But verses 13 to 16, he has one more kind of crummy thing to say about humanity that he's noticed, and it's about leaders, and it's the fact that all leaders fail and people are fickle. He's a leader. He's a king. So notice what he says, verses 13 to 16. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. For he's come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his own kingdom. I've seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the next lad who replaces him. That means the next young king who replaces the old one. There's no end to all the people, to all those who were before them. And even the ones who will come later will not be happy with the new king, with him. For this too is vanity and striving after wind. You know what this is? It's a parable of a king, an old king who now writes about when he was young and when he had morals and when he had wisdom. Who do you think he's talking about? It's got to be Solomon. And he remembers back when he had, what he says, let me tell you a story about a young guy who had wisdom and he walked with God. But he got older. And then he was at a point where he wouldn't receive any more wisdom. He wouldn't receive any instruction. He got hardened. And he wouldn't listen. And he says it would be better to be the lad. It's better to be that lad. And furthermore, he says, the people, the big crowds that came around, he says, as soon as this king's gone, the next lad that comes along, the next young, good-looking king that comes along, they're going to throng after him because they're so fickle. He says, this is vanity. It's emptiness. You know, people say, oh, I want to be involved in leadership or government, or I want to wield some power. I want to be... Talk to the people that are in it. And if they're honest with you, they'll say it's emptiness. It's emptiness. It doesn't fulfill. The wielding of power does not fulfill. Owning big lots of stuff, being a king, being a governor, being in charge, having power. It's one of the lusts that we have. You know, money, sex, power. These are the things humans think they want. And every one of them will let you down. Every single one of them. And Solomon knew more than anybody. That's why he comes to that last one. He says, leadership fails. The whole power structure fails. It's vain and empty. Do you notice what he went through? Crime is everywhere. Abuse is rampant. Greed is common. And all the leaders fail. If you're looking for life and meaning under the sun, my friend, don't hold your breath. So what do we do? Well, let me, just out of what we've talked about here, let me share three things not to do and three things to do. And I'll try and keep it brief. Three things not to do. Number one, don't overexpect from this life. Did you ever go to a movie that everybody hyped up and you went in and it wasn't as good as they thought, as they told you it was going to be? See, when you overexpect out of life, it is an abysmal disappointment. Don't overexpect out of life. It's one of the problems. This life promises stuff it never comes through with. That's why people who know God and they don't expect this life to be all that great, when it is pretty good, they go, wow, this is cool. I'm happy. I'm content. Because they didn't ever expect it to be as wonderful as everybody tried to advertise it, you see. So don't overexpect. Don't overexpect of your day, of your career, of your marriage, of your friendships. Don't overexpect of your church. Don't overexpect of anything in this world. And don't let yourself fall into the trap of overexpectation. Because when that expectation is failed, and it will be, people will fail you, things will fail you, money will fail you, business will fail you. What will happen is you go into a nosedive, you get angry and frustrated and bitter, and you become part of the problem instead of part of the solution. It's interesting because Jesus, they tried to make him king on more than one occasion. And in one particular time, they were just wowed about who he was. And it says, he got away from them because he knew what was in their hearts. He knew what was in their hearts. We got to know what this world has to offer, and we got to not put our faith in what's going on here. Don't overexpect from this life. Secondly, don't overplan this life. Or if you're going to plan, and planning isn't bad, but don't overplan. Because chances are about 30 or 40% of your plans are going to fall apart. So it's okay to plan, but don't put all of your weight on it. Solomon says, hey, look at all the stuff that goes wrong. So you better have a bigger idea about eternity and about what you're really about so that you can go ahead and plan but then not care if it doesn't all go your way. It doesn't all turn out the way you want it to. Don't overplan this life. Live within the rhythms that God has built in his sovereignty. Live within them. Third, another thing not to do, don't overanalyze this life because it can't be figured out. Oh, if I think real hard, read lots of books on philosophy, I'll be able to figure out what's going on. No, you won't. You read lots of books on philosophy, you'll get really confused. You'll end up on drugs. You'll end up needing drugs if you're not on them already. I'm not kidding you. Take a lesson from Timothy Leary. you will not get wiser by reading a bunch of human philosophy, by overanalyzing life. You know what? Sometimes you just have to live it. Sometimes you just have to say, you know, there's a bunch of unanswered questions out there. I do not understand them all. I'm going to keep pressing on with the Lord. I'm going to answer what I can answer. I'm going to learn what I can learn. I'm going to leave a lot of questions to be answered when I get to heaven. That is the only way to live happily and balanced in this life. It's the only way. You've got to leave lots of room for mystery, lots of room for things to get goofed up, lots of room for people to say to you, why did that happen? And for you to say, I have no idea. But we don't want to say that to people. People do this to pastors all the time. Pastor, why did this happen? And I said, well, just a second, I'll tell you. I'm going to phone the Lord here for a moment, and he'll give me the answer, then I'll tell you. I have no idea. And sometimes I just say, I just don't have any idea why it happened. Well, it's not bad to actually live that way. Don't overanalyze life. Sometimes you just have to look back, and what you know, and what you don't know, you don't know. You just walk with God. That's what he says. That's why he says it over and over again. He says, look, just do what you can do and trust God. Not bad. Well, okay, then let's move into the positives. What do we do? Number one, enjoy what God has given you in simple pleasures. And that's what he says in verses 12 and 13 of chapter 3. There's nothing better than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. And every man who eats and drinks and sees good in his labor, that's a gift from God, so enjoy the simple things. Enjoy the simple things that God has given you. And don't be longing after something else. Say, Lord, thank you for giving me what you've given me. Ah, I love it. Thank you. Enjoy what is enjoyable. The decision to enjoy today for what it is actually a very faithful decision. That's what Jesus told us to do, too, one day at a time. So enjoy what God has given you. That you can do. Secondly, see life in terms of quality rather than quantity. Chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Now, the reason I mention those, look at those. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. One hand full along with rest is the idea. Is better than two fists full, but having striving after wind. What's he getting at? These are two proverbs. And he lays them next to each other. They're, you know what he's getting at? He's in the greed section. What he's saying is, now listen carefully. He's saying, you're telling me only a lazy guy rests. That's the first proverb. That was one that they quoted to each other all the time. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. In other words, lazy people don't get anywhere. He says, that's what I hear from all you greedy people. That's what this author is saying. He says, I hear everybody say this. He says, I'm going to quote one back to you. He said, it's better to have a little and be at peace in your soul than to have a lot and be fighting and striving. Now, Proverbs actually says both of those in a bunch of different ways. And you remember in Proverbs how it does say that. Here's the deal. Greed and godless ambition often masquerade as hard work, which really is a virtue. Hard work is a virtue. But greed is idolatry. And so this author says, I want quality in my life, not just quantity. And I am going to ask the question, do I need more? Do I have to work more? Is my life, am I giving up something intangible that is quality to me in order to get more quantity? And that's a question our world has got to ask. And this author says, you want to do something practical for yourself? Ask the tough question. Do I really need more? Or would it be better for me to live on less and increase the quality of my life? Richard Swenson, who's an MD, gave up a lucrative medical practice, took a job at half the income, just so he could spend more time with his family. And he learned it on the mission field. He went to the mission field and discovered his life was simple on the mission field for a year as a medical missionary. It was the happiest year he'd had in years. And he came back and he said, that's it. And he and his wife systematically simplified their life. Maybe it's time to do that, you know. Or maybe you've said, you know, my life has been radically simplified and I didn't decide. And so I think God is punishing me. It wasn't my decision. I'm still striving. I want more. I'm trying to get more and more and more. And God is saying, no, 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 and he's taking it away. You know what? He might be doing you a huge favor. Because this says, and all wisdom literature from the Lord says, go for the quality, not the quantity of your life. And when you do, you will be able to enjoy the simple things that God has given you. And here's the last one. Put relationships before possessions. Now, I told you we'd come back to chapter 4, verses 9 to 12. Two are better than one. Why does he put this little section about, we use these in weddings, you know, this is always quoted in weddings, a triple braided cord is not easily broken. But you know what, really what he's saying here is the relationships are worthwhile. You want to make your life work, my friend? Look at the emptiness of the world and the busyness of it. Put your relationships first and your stuff second. If you just say, okay, and beginning with your most intimate ones first, okay, marriage, close friendships, family, and so on. You start with those. You don't start with the gas station attendant, you know. You start with the people who know you the best. Those are the relationships you work on first. And you say, I refuse to argue and fight about anything that has anything to do with anything that's going to burn on earth. I will not fight about anything that I know I'm going to leave behind when I die.
Well, what are we going to do?
We ran out of stuff to fight about. Try it. Try putting, honest and truly, putting relationships first. And everything else second. You know, if everybody in a family did that, if even just mom and dad did that in a nuclear family, there'd be no meltdown in the family. What an amazing thing. Put relationships first. I came across an interesting thing. This summer, huge business in the Midwest, Thompson McCully Company, it was a paving company, was sold. Bob Thompson, 67 years old, sold his company for $422 million. And you know what he did? He gave away $130 million to the employees of the company. It's an amazing thing. Some of them became instant millionaires. He didn't give everybody the same amount. But his words are worth reading. He and his wife decided to do this. And he says, what was I going to do with all that money anyway? Besides, I'm in a business where my employees have to work all day and half the night. They have to work in tough weather like the 90-degree days we've been having. It's hard work. It's not like I invented some software and they made me a lot of money. My people have to be really dedicated, and I know I couldn't be successful without them. So he gave away all this money, and he says, I'm not done giving away my money. They set up a foundation to give away more. And he says, a lot of folks take a lot of money and spend it on themselves. He says, that's okay. That's fine. That's the way it is. But he said, we've decided not to do that. Maybe we can embarrass them or influence them, and that's fine too. I thought, what an amazing thing. I wonder if they're Christians. That's what I wonder. I wonder if someone, it never tells you in the news, you know, the news just takes God out of everything, but I kind of wondered if they were. Anyway, they set up a foundation to give away more money. Now, you may say to yourself, well, if I hadn't $422 million, I'd give away 130 of it too, because I'd have plenty left to live on. You know something? I don't believe that. The first thing I thought when I read that, I thought, well, shoot, man, if I was a multi-bazillionaire, I'd be giving money away too. I'd be doing it all over. But on the other hand, I've noticed that the more zeros there are behind the decimal point, the tighter I want to grab on and the harder it is to let go. My conviction about myself only here, is that if I wouldn't give away out of $100, give away a portion of that, of the same proportion here. If he had 422, gave away 130, we'll round it down to 25%. If I wouldn't give 25 out of my 100, chances are I wouldn't give 25 million out of my 100 million either. I think it's just human nature, isn't it? So the point is not how many zeros there are. The point is what's going on in the heart. And it's not just about this guy and his money. It's about us putting relationships first and money second. You want to learn to live the way Ecclesiastes actually advises to live? You see, was there life advice in Ecclesiastes? I mean, is there anything wisdom to learn, advice for how to live that would make life work better? Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Let's take a moment and bow our heads and ask the Lord to give us that wisdom. Father, we thank you you understand us so well, Lord, and you have created all of the system in which we live. Oh, we know that it is a sinful system and that you're not responsible for the sin. Yet it's very obvious that you have allowed it to get this way so that people would give up on themselves and fear you and learn to live in real wisdom. Father, we would come before you even at Christmas time. We have much to enjoy at Christmas time, many simple pleasures that you've given to us, and we love it. We love the Christmas season, Father, so many good things about it. And we pray that you would bless it among your people. But we also pray, Lord, that the wisdom that you grant to us to look beyond what the world says, that that wisdom will be ours at a very deep, deep level, to set us free from the worry and the anger and the fear that is epidemic in our world. Let us live differently, Father, learning wisdom from Solomon and by the power of your Spirit. Let us rejoice in simplicity. Let us rejoice in the good things that you've given us and live according to the priorities that you, from eternity, have laid out to us. We thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.